I next met with Dr. Leora Horn. And to begin, we talked about perhaps the most exciting developing area in cancer treatment overall and in lung cancer, immunotherapy, and specifically checkpoint inhibitors, including ipilimumab and the anti-PD-1 and anti-PD-L1 inhibitors.
Immune checkpoint inhibitors are really changing the way we think about immunotherapy in lung cancer. For the different classes, so there's a CTLA-4 inhibitor, it's like ipilimumab and tremelimumab. And the data with ipilimumab was really in conjunction with chemotherapy. It was not single agent data. There was a large phase 2 trial where ipilimumab was added to chemotherapy in both small cell and non-small cell lung cancer. And there were two different regimens that was used. There was a phased regimen where you had chemotherapy and then ipilimumab was added in. And then there was a concurrent regimen where you had ipilimumab upfront with chemotherapy. And they saw some promising results with the phased regimen. And so that led to two large randomized phase 3 trials, one in non-small cell and one in small cell, looking at the phased regimen of ipilimumab with chemotherapy compared to standard of care chemotherapy. Those trials have closed, and so we're waiting to see what the results are. And the difference between the CTLA-4 inhibitors and the PD-1, PD-L1 inhibitors is the PD-1 and PD-L1 inhibitors appear to have single-agent activity. We don't need chemotherapy when we're using those agents, and so we can eliminate the toxicities from chemotherapy when we're using these agents. I personally think that these PD-1 and PD-L1 inhibitors are some of the most exciting drugs that we have in lung cancer now. The response rates are in the range of around 20 to 30% are much higher than the response rates that we see in second-line chemotherapy. And there are multiple agents that are currently in clinical trial, and right now we can't really distinguish one agent from another. We can't really say one agent is better than the other because they all seem to have these rapid, durable response rates. And what's incredible about these drugs is with chemotherapy, you use chemotherapy and it works for a period of time, but then it stops working. And you really can say the same thing for targeted agents, the EGFR TKIs, the ALK inhibitors. They work for a period of time, but patients develop acquired resistance. And with the immunotherapy agents, what's incredible is that when they work, patients are having long, durable responses. We have some patients who are on the early phase 1 trials who have finished their 2 years of treatment with the anti-PD-1 inhibitors, and they're in follow-up. They have not required retreatment more than 18 months to 20 months later. And that for lung cancer is really unheard of. Some of the things that we're trying to sort out with the immune therapy agents is who do they work in? And there are several drugs that are specifically being developed in patients with tumors that have high expression of PD-L1. An expression of PD-L1 is graded anywhere from 1% to 100%, depending on the different company and the different assays that are being used. And it does appear that in patients whose tumors are positive for expression of PD-L1, that the responses are higher. But what's interesting is that we are also seeing responses in patients with tumors that are PD-L1 negative. And so I don't think we've completely figured out who these drugs should or should not be used in at this point.
Could you try to explain sort of mechanistically how you visualize how an anti-PD-1 agent works, how an anti-PD-L1 agent, and how a CTLA-4 agent works? Like, what part of the elephant are they all working on?
Sure. So you have your tumor that expresses antigens that then is presented to antigen-presenting cell. You get activation through dendritic cells and T cells. And the T cells then get trafficked to the tumor. The CTLA-4 inhibitors inhibit where you have the trafficking of the T cells. The T cells then infiltrate the tumor, and that is really within the tumor or the tumor microenvironment where you have PD-L1 and PD-1 acting. Now, PD-L1 and PD-1 in the normal body actually act together to dampen the immune response. So that if you have activation of T cells, PD-L1 and PD-1 work together to prevent overactivation of T cells so you don't get an immune response throughout the body. What these anti-PD-L1 agents are doing is they're blocking, they bind to PD-L1, they're preventing the interaction between PD-1 and PD-L1. And so you can continue with that immune activation within the tumor microenvironment with the PD-L1 inhibitors. The anti-PD-1 antibodies obviously block PD-1, And again, by blocking PD-1, you can allow that activation of the immune response within the tumor microenvironment. The big difference between the anti-PD-1 and the anti-PD-L1 agents is that the anti-PD-1 antibodies bind to both PD-L1 and PD-L2. And PD-L2 is what's expressed in the lung in addition to other organs. And when these anti-PD-1 agents are sometimes affecting that PD-L2 anti-PD interaction, that's sometimes where you might see these cases of pneumonitis that are being reported in these patients. Whereas PD-L1 antibodies do not bind to PD-L2. And so we haven't seen the same cases of severe or fatal pneumonitis with the anti-PD-L1 antibodies.
So it's sometimes hard with these new agents, and you start to hear stuff. I was just thinking about carfilzomib and, you know, the dyspnea these people maybe experience. So we've heard about pneumonitis, but it's kind of hard, first of all, for me to get a feel from the data. Does it really happen? How often does it happen? And have you seen any cases that you thought that's what it was? And was it really full-blown, or you can kind of pick it up early just by asking for symptoms?
So we have had a few cases of pneumonitis on different agents. The key with the pneumonitis is educating patients that this could happen. So one of the things that we always talk to patients about is if you become more short of breath, if you start coughing, having difficulty breathing, you need to go to your local emergency room or come to Vanderbilt. We have a lot of patients who travel a fair distance to come here. And so I've actually seen it play out in two different ways. We had a patient who had those symptoms, came to our emergency room, had a CT scan. We saw pneumonitis and immediately started the patient on methylprednisolone, which we know is the key to treating the pneumonitis steroids. And he got better fairly quickly, within 72 hours, turned around, went home, and was on a slow steroid taper from home. I have another patient who lives a fair distance, and so rather than traveling 4 hours not feeling well, got admitted to his local hospital. Forgot to mention to the local hospital that he is on the clinical trial and that they need to call us. And unfortunately, his spouse did not call us either. And so this patient was in the intensive care getting antibiotics and other agents for a presumed pneumonia before we found out about him, called the local hospital. We found out about him because he didn't come to his doctor's appointment. We called to see where he was, called the local hospital, and they immediately started him on the high-dose steroid regimen that we recommended. And it took him a lot longer to get better, so he was in hospital for another 10 days and then had to go to rehab because he spent a week in the ICU before steroids were introduced. Now, the pneumonitis and colitis is the other severe toxicity these drugs can cause, is not common. We've only had a handful of patients experience this at Vanderbilt. It doesn't necessarily seem to be related to prior history of radiation therapy, which is a common treatment modality in lung cancer patients. It's not necessarily tied to one tumor type. We can't say it's more common in squamous than non-squamous. It just appears to happen. And I think the key to managing the pneumonitis and the colitis is early intervention.
You know, I heard a lot about colitis, and we hear a lot about it in terms of ipilimumab, but you're the first person that actually brought this up. Maybe it's in the, I'm sure it is in the papers. So you've seen clinical cases. Is it like what happens with ipi?
It's the exact same as what happens with ipi. We had one case where we had to give the patient infliximab in the end to treat them because it did not improve with standard treatment. And so it can be as severe as what we see with ipi.
So in the data that's out there, what is the going thinking about the risk of pneumonitis and colitis?
The risk is less than 5%. And so it is grade 3-4 pneumonitis. The risk is less than 5%. You might see small infiltrates on patients' CT scans that come and go with therapy, but the risk of a severe pneumonitis that requires intervention and therapy is less than 5% with any of the agents that we've seen. I think the toxicity is much, much less with these agents compared to ipi. I think ipi is definitely a much more toxic drug. I would say that less than 10% of patients have had major issues. One thing that we have seen quite commonly is hypothyroidism. And so we routinely monitor these patients, their TSH, their T3, T4.
Can you pick out a patient from your practice who typifies the clinical benefits you've observed with this kind of treatment?
Sure. I have several. I have a delightful 85 now-year-old lady who had progressed on chemotherapy several years ago. She had had first-line chemotherapy, didn't like it very much.
What tissue type?
Adenocarcinoma. And
wild type?
EGFR, ALK, wild type, positive for KRAS mutation. So common mutation in lung cancer for which we have nothing to offer. And so she came to us to find out about clinical trials, partly because she just didn't want to waste Medicare money on chemotherapy anymore.
Wow.
And so, you know, a lot of people are worried about putting 80-plus patients on clinical trials, but she went on the phase one trials with nivolumab, and this was 3.5 or 4 years ago, and had a great response to therapy, got three-quarters way through her therapy, and had an allergic reaction to the drug. And so we had to stop treatment.
What kind of allergic reaction?
She had flushing, edema, close to anaphylaxis.
Wow. Has that been reported?
Allergic reactions to the infusion have been reported.
Huh. I'm assuming you don't give corticosteroids with the infusions.
We don't give it with infusion unless a patient has some sort of reaction. So there are some patients who we did give corticosteroids with, or Benadryl, H2 blockers with the infusion. And she had her allergic reaction, had to come off study. She's now been off study in January. It's going to be 2 years. Saw her about 3 weeks ago. Her disease has not progressed. She's traveling around the country. She's a snowboard, so she doesn't stay in Nashville during the winters. And doing fantastic, and has not had to have any further therapy.
Certainly worth thinking about. It also kind of gets into the question of, there are a lot of cost issues and regulatory considerations that are over my head, but just from a simple physician point of view, hearing a story like that and going, well, you know, I think if I had this metastatic adenocarcinoma, maybe I'd want to get on a trial of this, and should this be available? If you can, you know, identify a bunch of people with stories like the one you did, which is the same story Dave Spiegel told of an 82-year-old lady at this other meeting. You know, again, we see it with a lot of agents. Ibrutinib, you know, people are kind of going crazy before that got approved because it obviously worked. So do you think these agents are going to be coming into practice soon?
I hope so. Different agents are in different stages of development. I think, if anything, the first agent that may be available will be nivolumab. They were further ahead in development. The large randomized phase 3 trials in both squamous and non-squamous lung cancer patients have closed. The phase 2 trial in squamous cell lung cancer patients has closed. And hopefully the data from those trials is what's going to allow these agents to be out there for patients. There are still ongoing trials, phase 2 and 3, with the MedImmune agent, with the Merck agent MK3475, pembrolizumab, with the Genentech drug MPDL3280A. And I would not be surprised if shortly after some of these other agents become available on the market. The issue is right now with these agents, the only data that we have for them is in second line and beyond. And for patients who have EGFR and ALK rearrangements, it's second line and beyond chemotherapy plus an EGFR TKI or an ALK TKI. We don't have first line data, but those studies are currently ongoing. And so in a few years, we may even have first line data of using these drugs instead of chemotherapy.
You know, you think about the recent approval of ceritinib, and I want to ask you about ALK inhibitors. And I mean, there wasn't any phase 3 data there, right?
Correct. Ceritinib got FDA approval based on, you know, just over 200 patients.
Right. Again, all you had to hear are some of these cases and see a little bit of data. Even though we don't really seem to know the target yet for these anti-PD-1 agents, it kind of seems like a similar type of scenario. How do you think the anti-PD-1 versus anti-PD-L1 thing is going to play out? I guess you sort of hinted that maybe there might be less toxicity with anti-PD-L1. I kind of got the feel from you that maybe globally the efficacy maybe is going to be hard to separate out.
I do think the efficacy is going to be hard to separate out. And the major difference in toxicity between the PD-L1 and the PD-1 has been the pneumonitis. I don't know if it's really going to come down to cost and if one agent is just as effective. Again, those toxicities are still very low and very rare and less than chemotherapy. But if both agents are equally effective and one agent is significantly cheaper, with the cost of healthcare these days, we really need to think about the cost of these drugs. And I would use the cheaper drug.
We brought up the issue of ALK and ziritinib, and I was curious. I see a paper, a poster from this recent ASCO meeting of a phase one trial of X396. And actually, I like that name, X396. I think that'd be kind of like a good trade name too, but I'm sure it won't be. Anyhow, maybe you can talk about, first of all, where we are with, I guess, first generation, second generation, ziritinib and other second generation, and what this is.
So we've had crizotinib on the market now for several years in the U.S., and it is an effective ALK inhibitor. But the big issue with crizotinib is that crizotinib does not have great CNS penetration. And we know that for patients who have ALK-positive lung cancer, there is a 70% response rate almost to crizotinib and approximately a 10-month progression-free survival. And almost half of those patients will progress in the brain. And at the time of progression, now we have a second-generation ALK inhibitor that is approved, ziritinib, for patients with acquired resistance to crizotinib. And again, the response rate with ziritinib was impressive in the high 50s. The data at ASCO this year showed us a progression-free survival of about 8 months on patients who were on crizotinib and then progressed on ziritinib. There was also some patients who had first-line ziritinib in the trial, although we do not know what the PFS is yet on those patients. But what was also impressive is the CNS responses that we saw with ziritinib, but it wasn't in all patients. And so there are multiple second-generation inhibitors that are still in clinical trial. Alectinib is still in clinical trial. There's an ARIAD compound that's still in clinical trial. And then we had been working very closely with Xcovery in developing X396. It was originally, a lot of the preclinical data was done by Christine Lovely in the lab of William Powell at Vanderbilt. And we were really excited to open the phase one trial. And similar to the other second-generation inhibitors, we're seeing really great response rates in the mid-50s, durable responses to X396. The trial has only enrolled about 35 patients at this point. In the initial dose escalation, not all patients were ALK-positive. And so now in the expansion, we are only enrolling ALK-positive non-small cell lung cancer patients. I think the issue with ziritinib that may become important in the future is ziritinib had quite a high rate of GI toxicities, nausea, diarrhea, and I don't think that we can underplay those toxicities because they do affect patients' quality of life. And so for patients on ziritinib right now, we need to be very careful about how we manage those toxicities, being really aggressive with things like loperamide or antiemetics. But that may become significant if we see that these other second-generation inhibitors that are out there do not have the same toxicity profiles, yet give us the same responses.
So could you talk a little bit at a very basic level about, I don't know, the difference in structure and function of crizotinib, what that hits, what lectinib hits, what ziritinib hits, and what X396 hits, and what's first generation, second generation?
So the drugs are all hitting similar targets, although what we know is that there are different mechanisms that you can become resistant to crizotinib. L1196 is a common mechanism of resistance that has been described, but there are several other mechanisms of acquired resistance. The difference in the structure of the drugs often has to do with the compound itself will be similar. There may be slightly differences in hydrogen bonds, etc., between the different structures of the agents. What is different about the drugs, though, is which of the second-generation agents work with which mechanism of acquired resistance. And for patients who develop acquired resistance to ALK inhibitors, the story is not as simple as patients who develop acquired resistance to EGFR inhibitors, where 50% of patients will have T790M. With ALK, it's a little bit more of a messy picture. And some of our data has not been published, but we know that our agent, X396, may affect some of the mechanisms of acquired resistance that these other agents do not affect. But that's data that's not yet publicly available.
And I don't know if I'm confusing this with some other new agent, but has hepatic toxicity been reported with these agents?
So with crizotinib, there was some hepatic toxicity, elevations in liver function tests. There was some neutropenia. And there were also some of the visual changes where patients were going from dark to light and they were reporting halos. We haven't seen that as much. We have seen some hepatic toxicities with some of the second generation inhibitors. We haven't had as many of the visual changes reported with these second generation inhibitors. And that may also have to do with differences in what the compound hits. So we know that crizotinib was actually developed as a MET inhibitor, and we know it affects MET. There was data from Ross Camage at ASCO this year showing crizotinib being active in patients with high MET expression by FISH. We know it affects patients who are ROS1 fusion positive, but we don't know with these newer agents. I can speak about X396 that it is not as good against MET as it is against ALK. And so some of the toxicities may be off-target, some of the toxicities are off-target effects of these agents. And that, again, may sort out which agent you select to use when these drugs are all available for lung cancer patients.
Any thoughts about or theories about what might take targeted therapy, particularly EGFR mutants and ALK rearrangements, and sort of go to the next level, either cure or like very, very prolonged freedom from disease? Do you think that some kind of targeting of the mutation is going to be enough, or are you going to need to do something else like immunotherapy?
So I don't think we're going to cure these patients using these drugs as single agents. And I think that the key is going to be using these drugs in some sort of combination. What the appropriate combination is, whether it's multiple EGFR TKIs, whether it's an EGFR TKI with immunotherapy, I think that that remains to be determined. Although immunotherapy on its own in a subset of patients may cure patients without ever needing to use these additional drugs.
Do you have a patient with an ALK tumor that you could present, either someone who received this new agent or maybe just somebody who got crizotinib, just to walk people? I mean, you know, you all in lung cancer don't even see that many ALK patients, but people in practice never see it. You know, so sometimes I wonder, should we really even be talking about it? But, I mean, they need to know about it if they see it, but they do not see it much. So it might be helpful to just walk through a case in terms of what happened, side effects, et cetera.
Sure. I think that we need to talk about it because patients need to be tested for it. And even though it is not common, ALK was discovered in a smoker in Japan, although ALK has become known as a mutation that occurs in never smokers. But I think that all patients, smokers and never smokers, who have adenocarcinoma should be tested for ALK. A patient that comes to mind is a patient that I've known now for almost 8 years, who presented initially with stage 4 disease and went on chemotherapy, a clinical trial at that time with chemotherapy and bevacizumab. She was on the clinical trial for about 2 years, progressed on bevacizumab, and because at the time she was a light form of smoker, we tried her on erlotinib when she progressed. So this was back in the beginning of 2009. And she blew through erlotinib very quickly, had significant progression. And so we switched her over to a different chemotherapy, and then all the talk about ALK started. And so we talked about, well, let's send your tumor for testing, see what happens. And she came back as ALK positive. I still remember phoning her to tell her she was ALK positive because she was about a sixth or seventh patient that was ALK positive. And she went on to therapy with crizotinib. And she did beautifully with crizotinib, and she kept saying how great she felt with crizotinib. It was not chemo. Her hair was coming back. She was getting back to work and just her usual day-to-day activities. And she remained on crizotinib for just over 2 years. And then she progressed in the brain.
Did she have the visual things?
She did have some of the visual changes with crizotinib. She did not have any elevation in liver function tests. She didn't get neutropenia. She had a tiny bit of nausea initially, but she figured out very quickly how to manage that with food, not necessarily medication.
When do you see the visual thing, and how long does it stay around?
The visual thing can happen shortly after the drug is started. But it's very brief, so patients will notice when they turn the lights on in the morning that they may see some flashes or halos. Where it can be more of an issue is driving at night with headlights coming towards you. And so some patients are significantly affected. Younger patients don't seem to have as much issue with the headlights. It may just be if we're older, our eyes are poorer to begin with. But she didn't have many issues, although her husband probably was doing most of the night driving. And after 2 years of crizotinib and progression in the brain, she had whole brain radiation, and we started her on our phase one trial with X-396.
Could I just ask you, did she have symptoms from the brain mets?
She did. She had symptoms that prompted us to screen her brain. At the time, she came in with headaches, nausea, and dizziness. And so at the time, I was not doing routine screening of the CNS in patients on crizotinib. I have to say that now, as I've used the agent more and more, around a year, I will start scanning patients' brains every 4 to 6 months because we know of the high rate of progression within the CNS, and so potentially catching it before patients become symptomatic.
So, because before you go on with that case, I'm curious, in people with asymptomatic brain mets, depending, of course, on the history, but do you ever consider using targeted therapy, either anti-ALK therapy or EGFR therapy, and holding off on radiation?
Yes. So I actually have a young man in my clinic now who's in his late 30s who presented with metastatic disease, never smoker, ALK positive, and had about 20 brain mets at presentation, but was asymptomatic from those lesions. And so I have treated him with single-agent crizotinib. And he has had a little bit of shrinkage in his CNS in addition to his peripheral disease. Whole brain radiation is definitely toxic. It has its side effects. And so I have used both crizotinib, and we're in our new amendment with X-396, we'll be treating patients with asymptomatic brain metastases as well.
So this patient got whole brain radiation, then what?
She had whole brain radiation, and then we started her on X-396, and she was one of the first crizotinib-resistant patients who went on the study. So we actually decided to get a PET scan on her prior to starting and 1 month into study, just as an additional evaluation. And she came in 1 month into study with a PET scan that basically showed her disease had all gone from hot to cold.
Wow.
Like, and sort of what you'd expect to see with a crizotinib-naive patient getting crizotinib. And she has now been on study for almost a year. Her CNS disease has also disappeared on therapy. Some of that was whole brain radiation therapy, but some of it I do think was the drug. And she's doing fantastic, continues on drug once a day.
Any GI issues?
We have seen a little bit of nausea with this drug, not to the same extent that's been reported with some of the other agents, in particular ceritinib. We have not seen elevated liver function tests. We've seen some edema, and we've seen some skin rash with this drug.
How about in this lady?
She had a little bit of edema, but she actually had quite a bit of edema on crizotinib, and her edema has been less than what it was on crizotinib. She has not had any nausea. She hasn't had any skin toxicities.
If you were to do a chart with all the well-studied ALK inhibitors, starting with crizotinib and et cetera, the other three that we've talked about, second generation, how do you rate right now the anti-CNS benefit or effect?
So with the second generation inhibitors, they're all reporting similar CNS penetration, and with ceritinib, alectinib, the ARIAD compound, and X-396, I think the CNS penetration is quite similar, and their reports are very similar with ceritinib, alectinib, and X-396. Crizotinib, we know, has less CNS penetration, and that's probably why a significant number of patients are progressing in the CNS.
Well, when you talk about penetration, what about clinical? If you did a waterfall plot of the brain lesions, do most of them shrink? I don't even know if it's been done, or, you know, what kind of responses do you see?
I think the only data that we have, or robust data we have, is with ceritinib in the responses. But if you look at the data, it's only been a handful of cases. So there hasn't been large series with multiple patients. And part of that is when these drugs start out in clinical trial, a lot of it requires patients to have treated CNS mets, not untreated. So I think that that's data that'll come out more in clinical practice as time goes by and as these drugs are used more frequently.
So you mentioned CNS penetration, but I mean, do we know that that is the difference, or is it just something about the anti-tumor benefit? I mean, has actual CNS penetration been studied?
So in a lot of the drugs, CNS penetration has not necessarily been studied in humans, but we know from mice. And so we know that, for example, X-396 and ceritinib as well, I believe, has about a 13% CNS penetration. I don't know the exact percent for crizotinib, but I know that it is less than what's reported with those agents.
That's interesting. Okay, let me just sort of think about where we're at right now, because I wanted to ask you about another thing, and maybe you can think of a case. I don't know if you've run into a case like this, which I'm curious if you've had any cases of question mark adjuvant therapy in a patient with EGFR mutation since ASCO. I don't know. I guess you're trying to get most of your patients on trial, or all of them. But I am curious whether, or even in the past, whether you had anybody where you either were tempted or actually used an EGFR. And I really want to hear what you think about Radiant.
Sure. So we do routine molecular testing on all our patients. So even patients coming for adjuvant therapy will have molecular testing. And I actually have a patient I'm treating now with adjuvant chemotherapy who on routine testing was found to have deletion 19. And she asked me about going on maintenance erlotinib after adjuvant chemotherapy.
How old is she?
She is 59.
Non-smoker?
Former smoker. Smoked for about 20 years.
What was the nature of her primary? How big was it?
She had stage 3A disease. I can't remember the exact size of her tumor, but she had N2 disease, which was not seen on PET or prior EBUS and was only found at the time of surgery.
Incidentally, what kind of chemo did she get?
So I gave her adjuvant cisplatinum and pemetrexed. A lot of us are at this point in time are extrapolating data from the metastatic setting and using it in the adjuvant setting. I always tell our trainees that the board answer is that adjuvant cisplatinum and vinorelbine is the data that we have for adjuvant treatment for lung cancer. But I've seen multiple patients, and I've done it myself, who are treated with cisplatinum and pemetrexed. For adeno, I often do cisplatinum and gemcitabine for squamous cell lung cancer patients. I don't often use cisplatinum and docetaxel just because I think the neuropathy is quite significant. And these are patients we want to cure, and we need to think about quality of life long term.
Well, it won't surprise you if I tell you that when we poll lung cancer investigators, by far the most common regimen used in adenocarcinoma is cis-pem. So with or without whatever you want to say about the data, that's what people are doing, exactly
yes.
what you
yeah.
are. Now, is she like the kind of person who's reading about this? Does she have any kind of academic background? Or
she is reading about it partly because she has some physicians in her family. And, you know, I told her I would not do adjuvant or erlotinib. Radiant was negative. It did show an improvement in disease-free survival, but there was no improvement in overall survival. And if you're looking at adjuvant data, the goal is cure. And so I do not think that at this time there is good data to support the use of adjuvant erlotinib. There are two large trials that are being launched, one looking at adjuvant erlotinib in EGFR mutant positive patients and the other trial of adjuvant crizotinib in ALK positive patients. And potentially, if those trials are positive, that may change our mind. There were a lot of discussion that came up with Radiant of looking at, should we be doing the EGFR TKI for longer, more than 2 years? But also, if you look at the Radiant data, not all the patients completed their 2 years of therapy. There was quite a high discontinuation of study drug. And while the drugs are fairly well tolerated, EGFR TKIs are not without toxicity. Rash and diarrhea can be quite significant and, again, affecting quality of life.
We were talking about second-generation ALK inhibitors, and we're hearing about, I don't know which generation, I guess it's second. And
third-generation EGFR
EGFR, where I'm hearing that there's not much rash and diarrhea because it doesn't hit native EGFR or something. Is that the case, and you think that would fit better into an adjuvant scenario?
That's a really good question. We have three third-generation EGFR TKIs in clinical trial at Vanderbilt, and they're incredibly well-tolerated compared to the first and second-generation inhibitors in terms of less rash. I wouldn't say there's no rash. We have seen some patients with rash and less diarrhea. And so potentially could we be using them in an earlier setting, maybe as time goes by? But these drugs don't hit wild-type EGFR, and that's why we're not seeing as high levels of rash and diarrhea that we've seen with the first and second-generation inhibitors.
Going back to EGFR, though, I guess we should clarify that Radiant isn't really the study that we want to see. Alchemist is like kind of the right idea. You know, you target mutants, but you know, Radiant, They used what, EGFR, IHC, FISH. Only some of the patients were mutants. They tried to break them out. I think all people want to know about is the mutants. Do you agree?
Correct. And so Radiant initially was designed for patients based on data from BR21 for patients who were EGFR positive by IHC and FISH. And as more data about EGFR mutations emerged, they modified their secondary endpoint for EGFR mutation positive patients for disease-free survival and overall survival. But even in the subset analysis in EGFR mutant positive patients presented by Dr. Kelly, there was an improvement in disease-free survival, but there was no improvement in overall survival. Alchemist is specifically for patients who are EGFR mutation positive or ALK fusion positive.
So you've had a few publications that I just wanted to briefly ask you about. Very interesting. One, acquired resistance of EGFR mutant lung adenocarcinomas to afatinib plus cetuximab associated with activation of mTORC. I'm just kind of curious in general. I guess your colleague William Powell was right in the middle of the idea, this thought of afatinib and cetuximab. What did you look at in this paper and it was just published? And where are we right now with this concept? Have you had people treated with this combination?
That data was clinical work that came out of the Yale group working with William. And William was really the person behind the combination of afatinib, cetuximab. He had preclinical data showing combination of afatinib and cetuximab was better than either afatinib or cetuximab on its own in mice who had L858R and T790M. And it was his data that led to the large phase 1b trial where we enrolled over 100 patients and treated them with combination of afatinib and cetuximab. What was really interesting about that trial is we saw responses in both T790M positive and T790M negative patients. And so a 30% response rate and then 50% of patients who had stable disease, so fairly high rate of disease control. The combination did have quite a bit more rash, not a big surprise when you've got an EGFR antibody and an EGFR TKI, and higher diarrhea than what we saw with single agent erlotinib or gefitinib. Where the concept is now is based on that data, there are two large trials that are being launched through the cooperative groups. There is the first-line trial that Dr. Sarah Goldberg is leading through SWOG of afatinib compared to afatinib and cetuximab as first-line therapy in patients with EGFR mutant lung cancer. And then there is the second-line trial that we will be opening through PRECOG looking at afatinib compared to afatinib and cetuximab in patients with acquired resistance to EGFR TKIs. The data that was published with mTOR was looking at, there was a lot of interest in why was this combination working in patients who were T790M negative. One of the other mechanisms of acquired resistance to EGFR TKIs is HER2 amplification that William previously published. And so this was another story of a group of patients with acquired resistance T790M negative who had responses to these agents. What it means going in the future is, do we need to have a third agent in there acting in addition to afatinib and cetuximab? I don't know. But there's a lot of hype, rightfully so, looking at the third generation EGFR TKIs. But these drugs only work in patients who have T790M as their mechanism of acquired resistance. And so that leaves us 50% of patients who don't have a third generation TKI that they can go to when their disease progresses. And that leaves us with combinations like afatinib and cetuximab, which I continue to use off-study in patients who have progressed on erlotinib.
Two simultaneous questions came to my head. One is question mark HER2. You said HER2?
Uh-huh.
Is that mutation or overexpression?
There were some data that was published on HER2 mutation and amplification as a mechanism of acquired resistance and maybe explained some of the efficacy we saw with afatinib, because we know afatinib targets HER2 in patients who are T790M negative.
Interesting. I never thought about it from that point of view. Yeah, because I had heard, I guess he had, Dr. Powell had, I guess, done work to say that most likely erlotinib would not be synergistic with cetuximab.
There was a trial at Memorial done prior to the afatinib-cetuximab combination and enrolled patients with erlotinib and cetuximab. The combination was even more toxic than afatinib-cetuximab, and there were no responses seen.
Yeah, no, I was wondering because I don't know that erlotinib has anti-HER2 effects and afatinib does, and I never thought about that. Maybe that's the difference. Is that possible, or?
It may explain some of the responses that we saw in the trial, but you are correct that erlotinib does not have the anti-HER2 effect that afatinib does.
And I'm curious, you talked about using this regimen even outside a trial. What do you see dermatologically? Are you more aggressive? Do you use preemptive stuff? And what actually happens?
So the derm toxicities are quite significant, even more so in the south where it's hot and humid, and I think that that often makes a rash worse. I'm more aggressive both at managing but also dose reducing. You know, on clinical trials, you're sometimes constricted by what you can do, but I quickly will dose reduce from the original trial regimen of afatinib 40 milligrams and cetuximab 500 down to cetuximab 250 and going down to afatinib 30. The cetuximab dose that we used in that trial was quite a bit higher than the doses that you see, for example, used in colon cancer patients.
So let's talk a little bit about work-life balance, burnout, and retirement plans. It seems like you're kind of interested in that because you're part of these two great papers that were just published in the JCO surveys of ASCO members looking at these issues. Let's start out talking about burnout.
So close to half of physicians may identify with some signs or symptoms of burnout. I think that those numbers in the U.S. will continue to go up around the world, really, as some of the higher pressures come with changes in reimbursement and changes in how practices are structured. We're seeing more and more physicians who are not able to be single standalone practices. They're joining hospital groups to manage their practices, to manage the finances of their practices. The things that may cause burnout in academics may be different. It's harder to get grants. It's harder to get research funding. And so those issues of burnout continue to be there, and some of them are not issues that we can fix. We can't necessarily change reimbursement. We can't necessarily change the issues that we have with decrease in grant funding and research dollars for academic physicians. But what we can hopefully do is improve the resources that we have for physicians who can identify that they may be becoming burnt out, and looking at coping mechanisms, groups, et cetera, that can help physicians who are going to burnout or who are burnt out. I know that at my institution, there's a Center for Professional Health where they have workshops for physicians who may be burnt out. And I think that we're going to have to look at improving and increasing those resources for physicians around the country.
So you said that the rate of burnout, and 50% sounds really high, is significantly lower in other specialties?
It's not significantly low in all other specialties, but oncology does have one of the highest rates of burnout. There have been studies done in other medical subspecialties, surgical subspecialties. Oncology has been identified in prior studies to have some of the highest rates of burnout, potentially because of the patient populations that we deal with, the stress of the job. But oncology does have a higher rate of burnout. Maybe it's because more of our patients ultimately may die. But the rate of burnout is definitely higher in oncology than some of the other specialties.
As you sort of interact with general medical, well, all kinds of oncologists, then could be that people are having problems, are going to be less visible. I don't know. But I mean, do you think that close to half of oncologists that you deal with seem burned out? Can you tell?
You can, you know, you can look around and you can see some people who are burned out, close to burning out. There are probably times where I can think of myself where I was close to, whoa, you know, I'm close to overwhelmed, too much, feel burnt out. But the key is to identifying those physicians and figuring out how we can help them, be it through social support or more professional support or workshops, courses.
What do you say to a first-year fellow who asked you how you personally deal with the stresses of being an oncologist, particularly in lung cancer?
I'm lucky. I love what I do. I get to wear two hats because I treat lung cancer and I run the clinical research program for our lung cancer, but I also do education in my other hat. And so while I have my focus on lung cancer and I love going to clinic, I love seeing patients in clinic, sometimes I get to take a mental break and do something different. And I think even at work, it's not a bad thing to take a mental break and do something different so that you can find those things that help and excite you in addition to what you're doing in clinic, because there are clinic days where you can feel really depressed. Several patients have progressed. Maybe someone's been put on hospice. Maybe you lost someone and got a phone call about that. But there are also clinic days where things are fantastic and patients are doing very well. I don't think the challenge often that I find is not going to clinic. It's the 7 hours of paperwork that follows clinic, including notes and dictations, et cetera. And so figuring a way to balance your clinical practice that gives you the time to do those other things that you are excited about is an important part of what I tell the fellows to think about.